This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Ground of Education. This is Lecture 6, entitled Teachers as Artists in Education, given on August 22, 1922. It is important for educators to understand the whole human being, and this becomes an imperative when we begin to observe the development of boys and girls between the 11th and 12th years. One usually fails to observe the more subtle changes and sees only the obvious transformations of human nature. Consequently, we believe we can help children merely by deciding which bodily movements should become physically stronger. However, to make their bodies strong, capable, and free of restrictions, we must reach the body during childhood through soul and spirit. Between the 11th and 12th years, a great change takes place in the human being. The rhythmic system, breathing and blood circulation, dominates between the change of teeth and puberty. When children are almost 10 years old, the rhythms of the blood and breathing systems begin to develop and flow more into the muscular system. The muscles become saturated with blood, and the blood pulses through the muscles in intimate response to inner human nature and the heart. Thus, between 10 and 12, people build up the rhythmic system in a way that corresponds to their inner disposition. When children reach 11 or 12, what lives in the rhythmic system and muscular system is passed into the skeletal system. Until the 11th year, the skeletal system is wholly embedded in and conforms to the muscular system. Between 11 and 12, the skeleton adapts to the external world. A mechanic and dynamic quality that is independent of the human being passes into the skeleton. We must become accustomed to seeing the skeleton as if it were an entirely objective thing and not concerned with the human being. When observing children younger than 11, we see that all their movements still come from their inner being. When we observe the way children over 12 walk, we see how they are trying to find their balance, inwardly adapting to leverage and balance and the mechanical nature of the skeletal system. This means that between 11 and 12, the nature of soul and spirit reaches all the way into the skeleton. Before this time, the nature of soul and spirit is much more inward. At this point, one has taken hold of the most remote aspect of human nature, the skeleton, and one's adaptation to the outer world is complete. Only now do we become a true child of the world. We live now with the mechanistic dynamic of the world, and now do we experience so-called causality in life. Before the 11th year, people really have no understanding of cause and effect. We hear the words and think we understand them, but we do not, because we control the skeletal system through the muscular system. Later, after the 12th year, as the skeleton adjusts to the outer world, it dominates the muscular system and influences spirit and soul through it. As a result, one now begins to understand cause and effect based on inner experience, an understanding of force. We begin to understand our experience of vertical and horizontal, and so on. Because of all this, we harm their development if we teach children mineralogy, physics, chemistry, or mechanics in a way that is too intellectual for children before the 11th year, because they do not yet have a corresponding experience of their inner mechanical and dynamic nature. Nor can children inwardly participate in the causal relationships in history before their 11th year. This tells us how to treat the souls of children before the skeletal system has awakened. Children can inwardly experience biography while they still live in the muscular system, through the intermediary of the blood system. They can always participate if we present specific historical images that please or displease them, images toward which they can feel sympathy or antipathy. Or we can present images of the earth, as I described yesterday. They can take in images related to the plant kingdom, because the muscular system is inwardly pliable. We can also show them what I explained about animals, and how that whole kingdom exists in a human being. A child can go along with this, because the muscular system is soft. On the other hand, if we teach children about the principle of levers or the steam engine before they reach 11, they cannot experience this inwardly, because the dynamic of their own physical nature has not yet developed. If we begin physics, mechanics, and dynamics at the right time, when children are about 11 or 12, whatever we present in thinking goes into the head and is met by what comes from their inner being, the experience of their own skeletal system. What we say to them unites with the impulse and experience that arises from the body. Thus a soul understanding arises, instead of an abstract intellectual understanding. This must be our goal. But what about teachers who must accomplish this? What should they be like? Imagine a teacher, for example, who knows from anatomy and physiology where all the muscle and bones are and what nerve cells look like. This is all very well, but it is intellectual knowledge, and does not take the children into account. They become, as it were, impermeable to one's vision. The children are opaque as black coal. One may know all the muscles and nerves, but not how the circulatory system plays into the skeletal system. If we are to understand this, our concept of the human makeup and inner configuration must be that of an artist. Teachers must be in a position to experience children as artists would. They must see everything in children as inwardly pliable. Now, a philosopher might say, well, if something is to be known, it must be logical. This is true, but this must be the logic of a work of art, which may be an inner representation of the world we see. We must accept an inner artistic idea and not dogmatically believe that the world has to be conceived logically. The ideas and feelings of teachers must be flexible. Teachers must realize that if they present ideas of dynamics and mechanics to children before they reach 11, they congest the brain and make it inflexible, so that as they grow it develops migraine and later still hardens. On the other hand, if we give children isolated historical images or stories before the 11th year, if we present pictures of the plant kingdom that show plants in connection with the countryside where they grow, such ideas go into the brain, but they go there by way of the rest of the nervous system into the whole body. They unite with the soft muscular system and the whole body. We lovingly build what is working within the children. Thus teachers see into children. Those who know only anatomy and physiology see children as opaque coal. But here they become transparent, and teachers see everything. They see what goes on in the individual children at their desks. Teachers do not need to cogitate and resort to some didactic rule. The children themselves show them what needs to be done. Children lean back in their chairs and no longer pay attention when something is done that is unsuitable for them. When you do the right thing for children, they become lively. Of course, we will occasionally have a lot of trouble trying to control this liveliness in children. You can control it, however, if you have something that is not appreciated enough in such cases, a sense of humor. Teachers must bring humor when they enter the classroom. Sometimes children can be very mischievous. There was one Waldorf teacher whose class of children, over 12, suddenly became inattentive to the lesson and began passing notes to one another under their desks. Of course, a teacher without a sense of humor might become angry and there would be a big scene. But she went right along with them and explained how the postal service works, and the children realized that she understood them. She went directly into the matter of mutual correspondence. They felt a bit ashamed, and order was restored. The fact is, no art can be mastered without humor, especially the art of dealing with human beings. This means that the art of education involves eliminating ill humor and anger from teachers. It means developing friendliness and love full of humor and fantasy for the children. Otherwise, the children see in their teacher the very thing they are forbidden to be. A class teacher must never respond to a child's anger by threatening to beat the anger out of that child. That would be terrible. Or a teacher might respond by grabbing something and throwing it to the ground where it is smashed. This is not a way to remove anger from a child. The proper way to act as an educator is to show children that anger is a mere object, and that for you it barely exists, and should be treated with humor. Until now I have been describing how the human being should be understood in general by teachers. But people are not just something in general. Even if we study the human being in such detail that we see clearly into the very activity of the muscular system before the 11th year and into the skeletal system after the 11th year, something extraordinarily vital still remains to be understood for the art of education: human individuality. Each child is different, and what I have described thus far is only the very first step in an artistic understanding of children. We must enter more and more into what is personal and individual. Provisionally, we are helped by the fact that the children we educate have different temperaments. From the very beginning, a real understanding of temperaments has been very important for the education I am describing as practiced in a Waldorf school. Let us begin by looking at melancholic children, a particular human type. What are they like? Externally, they seem quiet and withdrawn, but these outer characteristics do not help us much. We begin to comprehend children with a melancholic disposition only when we realize that they are affected most powerfully by their purely physical nature, and when we understand that melancholia is the result of an intense deposit of salt in the organism. This causes melancholic children to feel weighed down in the physical organism. It is a very different experience for a melancholic child to raise an arm or leg than it is for other children. There are impediments to raising an arm or leg. A feeling of weight opposes the soul's intention. Consequently, melancholic children gradually turn inward and do not enter the outer world with any pleasure, because the body is of such concern and intrudes on their attention. We can approach melancholic children correctly only when we realize how their soul and spirit would soar if they were not burdened by the bodily deposits continuously secreted by glands which permeate other bodily movements and encumber the body. We can help them only when we correctly understand this encroaching physical heaviness that imprisons their attention. It is often said that melancholic children brood inwardly, and that they are quiet and move very little. As a result, one purposely urges them to take in lively ideas, trying to heal through the opposite. One's treatment of melancholics is to enliven them by saying all sorts of amusing things. But this method is completely wrong. We cannot reach melancholic children this way. Through sympathy and understanding of their physical gravity, we must approach children in their own individual mood. Thus we do not give melancholics lively and comical ideas, but serious ideas, like those they produce themselves. Whatever we give them must be in harmony with the tone of their own burdened organism. Further, in education such as this, we must be patient. The effect is not immediate, but takes years. It works like this. When children receive, from outside, what they have within themselves, it arouses within them the healing forces of resistance. If we bring them something foreign, such as something comic, to a serious child, they remain indifferent. But if we confront them externally with their own sorrow and woe, they perceive what they have in themselves, and this evokes the opposite inner response. Thus we heal pedagogically by adapting the ancient golden rule to a modern method. Like not only recognizes like can heal like. When we consider children of a more phlegmatic temperament, we must realize that they live less in the physical body and more in what I call the ether body. This is a more volatile body. It may seem odd to say that phlegmatic children live in their ether body, but this is how it is. The ether body prevents the human processes of digestion and growth from entering the head. It is not in the power of phlegmatic children to conceive of what is going on in the body. The head becomes inactive. The body becomes increasingly active because of the volatile element that tends to scatter their activities into the world. Phlegmatic children are entirely surrendered to and absorbed into the world. They live very little within themselves, so they respond with a certain indifference toward what we do with them. We cannot reach them because immediate access must go through the senses. The principal senses are in the head, but phlegmatic children make little use of the head. The rest of the organism functions through interplay with the outer world. Again, as with melancholic children, we can reach phlegmatic children only when, as artists, we can turn ourselves into phlegmatics of some sort. Then they have at their side what they are in themselves. And with time this will seem too boring. Even phlegmatics eventually find a phlegmatic teacher boring. And if we are patient, we will see how something lights up in phlegmatic children if we present ideas calmly and speak to them phlegmatically about uninteresting events. Sanguine children are especially difficult. The activity of the rhythmic system very much dominates in them. The rhythmic system, which is dominant between the change of teeth and puberty, dominates sanguine children too much. Sanguine children, therefore, always want to move rapidly from one impression to another, and their blood circulation becomes hampered if impressions do not change quickly enough. They feel inwardly restricted if impressions do not pass quickly and give way to others. So we can say that sanguine children feel an inner constriction if they have to stay with any one thing too long, and they turn away to very different thoughts. It is hard to hold them. Once more, the treatment of sanguine children is similar to that of the others. We must not try to balance sanguine children by forcing them to stay for a longer period with one impression, but do the opposite. Meet the sanguine nature by changing impressions vigorously, making sure they have to take in impression after impression in rapid succession. Again, a response will be called into play, and this will certainly take the form of antipathy toward the fast pace of impressions, because the circulatory system dominates entirely. The result will be that the sanguine child slows down. Choleric children must be treated in yet another way. Choleric children are typically a step behind normal in development. This may seem strange, but let us take an illustration. Any normal children of 8 or 9 move their limbs quickly or slowly in response to outer impressions. But compare 8 or 9-year-old children with those of 3 or 4 who still trip and dance through life and have far less control of their movements. They still retain something of the baby in them. Babies do not control their movements at all, but kick around because the mental forces are not yet developed. But if tiny babies had a vigorous mental development, you would find them to be cholerics. Kicking babies, and the healthier they are, the more they kick, are all choleric. Choleric children come from a body made restless by choler. Cholerics retain something of the romping and raging of a tiny baby. Thus the baby lives on in choleric boys and girls of 8 or 9. This is why a child is choleric, and we must treat the child by trying gradually to subdue the baby within. In doing this, humor is essential. When we confront a true choleric of 8 to 10 or even older, we will accomplish nothing through admonition. But if I get this child to recount a story I have told previously, a story that requires a display of great choler and much pantomime, the child will sense the baby within, and this will have the effect, gradually, of calming the tiny baby. children will adapt it to the stage of their own mind. When I act choleric toward a choleric child, naturally with humor and complete self-control, the child will grow calmer. When teachers begin to dance, please do not misunderstand me, the raging child nearby gradually subsides. But one must avoid having a red or sad face when dealing with choleric children. One must enter this inner rage by means of an artistic sensibility. You will see that the child will become more and more quiet. This completely subdues the inner raging. This must not, however, be the least bit artificial. If there is anything forced or inartistic in what the teacher does, it will have no result. Teachers must indeed have artists' blood in them, so that what they enact in front of the children will seem real and be accepted without question. Otherwise, it will be something false in the teacher, and that must be avoided. A teacher's relationship to the child must be absolutely genuine. When we approach the temperaments in this way, it also helps us to keep even a very large class in order. Waldorf teachers study the temperaments of those children entrusted to them. They know that they have children who are melancholic, phlegmatic, sanguine, and choleric. They place the melancholics together, unobtrusively and without it being noticed, of course. They know they have these children in this corner. The one places the cholerics together and knows they're in another corner, and so on with the sanguines and phlegmatics. Using this social treatment, those of like temperament rub one another's corners off, so to speak. For example, a melancholic becomes cheerful when sitting among other melancholics. As for the cholerics, they heal each other thoroughly, since it is best to let cholerics work off their choler on one another. If bruises are exchanged, it has a very sobering effect. Through the right social treatment, the underlying interrelationships can be brought into a healthy resolution. The point is this. By way of the temperaments, one gets closer and closer to the individuality of the children and their personalities. Today, many people say that you must educate individually. This is true, but you must first discover the individual. First you must know the human being, then you must know the melancholic. In reality, a melancholic child is never purely melancholic. The temperaments are always mixed. One temperament dominates, and once you understand the temperament correctly, you will find your way to the individual. And if we have a good enough sense of humor, we may send a boy who is overwrought by rage into the garden and watch him climb trees and scramble around until he is truly tired out. And when he returns, he will have worked off his choleric temper on himself and with nature. Once he has worked off what is in him by overcoming obstacles, he will return, after a while, calmed down. This indeed shows that the art of education must be learned intimately. People today do not judge clocks, or at least I have not heard it. People do not usually consider the merits of a clockwork, because they do not understand how it functions. Thus you seldom hear a clockwork judged in ordinary conversation. But you hear people judging education wherever you go. Often it sounds as though people are talking about the works of a clock, about which they haven't the slightest knowledge. People do not realize that education must be intimately learned, and that it is not good enough to state abstractly that we must, quote, educate the individual, close quote. First, we must discover the individuality by gaining an intimate knowledge of the human being and the various temperaments. Then, we gradually approach what is uniquely individual in a person. This must become a life principle, particularly for artistic teachers. Everything depends on the contact between teachers and children, which must be permeated by an artistic element. This will bring about intuitively, almost instinctively, much that teachers must do whenever an individual child comes to them. Let us use a concrete illustration for the sake of clarity. Suppose we find it difficult to educate a certain boy because all the images we bring him, the impressions we wish to arouse, the ideas we would give, set up such a strong circulation in his head and disturb his nervous system so much that whatever we give cannot escape the head and go into the rest of his organism. The physical organism of the head becomes somewhat melancholic, in a sense. The boy finds it difficult to take what he experiences from his head into the rest of his organism. What he learns gets stuck, as it were, in the head. It cannot penetrate down into the rest of the organism. Artists in education will instinctively keep such a thing in mind in any specifically artistic work with this child. If I have such a child, I will use colors and paint with him in a very different way than with other children. Because it is so important from the very beginning, we give special attention to color in the Waldorf school. I have already explained the principle of the painting, but in the painting lesson we can treat each child individually. We have an opportunity to work individually with children, because they must do everything themselves. Now suppose I have a child such as I described. I am taking the painting lesson. If the right artistic contact exists between teacher and child, under my guidance this child will produce a very different painting from other children. I will draw roughly on the blackboard what would appear on a paper painted by the child whose ideas are stuck in the head. Something of this sort should arise in this picture. Here a spot of yellow, then further on a spot of, say, orange, for we have to keep in mind the harmony of colors. Next comes a transition to violet, and the transition may be differentiated more, and then to make an outer boundary the whole may be enclosed in blue. This is what we get on the paper of a child whose ideas are congested in his head. Now suppose I have another child whose ideas, far from sticking in his head, sift through the head as though it were a sieve. Everything goes into the body and the child grasps nothing, because the head is like a sieve with holes, allowing things to go through as it sifts everything. We must be able to sense that in this child, the circulatory system of the other part of the organism wants to draw everything into itself. Then one intuitively decides to get the child to do something different. In the case of this child, you will get something like this on paper, and there's a drawing. Observe how much less the colors go into curves or rounded forms. Rather, you find the colors drawn out. The painting approximates drawing, and you get loops that are more proper to drawing. You will also notice that the colors are not differentiated much. In the first drawing they are strongly differentiated, and here there is not much differentiation. If one does this with real colors, not with the nauseating substance of chalk which does not give an idea of the whole, then through the experience of pure color in the one case and more formed color in the other, we can work back upon the characteristics of the child I described. Similarly, when you go into the gym with a boy or girl whose ideas stick in the head, your goal will be different than if you were there with a child whose head is like a sieve, allowing everything through into the circulation of the rest of the body. You take both kinds of children into the gym with you. You get the one group whose heads are like a sieve to alternate gymnastic exercises with recitation or singing. The other gymnastic group, whose ideas are stuck in their heads, should do their movements as much as possible in silence. In this way you create a bridge between physical training and soul characteristics, out of the very nature of children themselves. Children who have stuck ideas must do gymnastics differently from those whose ideas simply flow through the head. This sort of thing shows how very important it is to compose education as a whole. It is terrible when a teacher first instructs children in a classroom and then they are sent off to the gym while the gymnastic teacher knows nothing of what has happened in class and simply follows a separate scheme in the gymnastic lesson. The gymnastic lesson must follow absolutely from what was experienced with children in class. In practice, therefore, the Waldorf school tries as much as possible to trust to one teacher even supplementary lessons in the lower classes, and certainly all that concerns general human development. This makes tremendous demands on the staff, especially in teaching art. It also demands the most willing and loving devotion, but there is no other way we can we can attain a wholesome, healing human development. Now, in the lectures that follow, I will describe on the one hand certain modeled and painted figures made in the studio at Dorna, so we can acquaint you better with eurythmy, the art of movement that is so intimately related to the whole human being. The figures bring out the colors and forms of eurythmy, and something of its inner quality. On the other hand, I will speak tomorrow about painting and other artistic work by the younger and older children in the Waldorf School. The end of Lecture 6.